This podcast may contain content that is graphic and disturbing in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come on and fly with me. Let's fly away.
An Australian man was in London, but wanted to return to Australia. He was broke and couldn't afford a plane ticket. And that's when he concocted a daring plan to ship himself to Australia in a box as air freight. This is Apple for the Teacher, a true crime podcast. I'm your host, Anna Thomas. Today's episode is called Cash on Delivery. The man smuggled himself to Australia in a box. What happened?
Once I get you up there, I'll be holding you.
This is now part two of the previous episode, Cash on Delivery, and it would be very beneficial for you to go back and listen to part one first before continuing on today's episode. So we saw in the previous episode that Reg managed to pull off his grand scheme of having himself shipped back to Australia in a box as air freight. So he arrived back in 1964, and after the media attention died down, he decided to continue with his javelin career. He continued competing in the Australian track and field competition for another 8 years. Although he kept on competing, he never achieved the status of the Australian javelin champion again. At the height of his career, he was earning money from media appearances, but that income dried up and money was tight again. So you can perhaps see where this may be heading. A lack of money had spurred him on to come up with a crazy plan to get himself back to Australia, and we saw how that ended up. So there he was. It was the year 1980. He was down on money again, and he became obsessed with thoughts about how he could improve his family's financial situation. And yes, as you guessed it, he came up with another crazy scheme, so let's see what happened. After much contemplation, he decided he was going to get money by smuggling drugs from Bombay, India, into Australia, but he couldn't do it by himself. He told his wife Annie all about the plan, and he also approached two other couples that he and Annie knew, and they agreed to be involved. So this made a total of six people. The first part of the plan involved one couple going to Bombay, India, and purchasing the drugs. They would then buy a cassette player and conceal the drugs inside. They would then take a flight back to Australia, and when departing the plane, the cassette player would be left in an overhead luggage compartment. The next couple would board that same plane and sit in the exact same seats. That flight would then go to New Zealand. The couple would take the player when they disembarked, go through security, and hand it over to Reg and Annie, who would fly the last leg back to Australia. Reg figured the plan should work as the Australian customs wouldn't check luggage coming in from New Zealand. So the plan was set into motion. The first couple headed to Bombay and bought cannabis resin, packing 1 kilogram bags into a cassette player. They flew back to Australia, where the second couple picked up the player and flew to New Zealand. The final part of the plan went off without a hitch, with Reg and Annie arriving in Australia with the drugs. It just seemed too easy to be true, and they continued to do more runs. But Reg thought it wise for the couples to swap the runs that they did each time so that no patterns could be detected. Now, just a side note, Reg's wife had previously been a teacher, as had one of the other women who was involved in the scheme. Annie discovered that after they had successfully completed two runs, the money they earned was as much as she had earned as a teacher for a whole year. One of the other couples involved in the smuggling was a man named Nico and a girl named Lara. After completing a number of runs, Lara started to get worried about her involvement, as she had a boyfriend, and as he didn't know about the drug smuggling, she kept having to give him excuses about why she would go away for a few days at a time. And it wasn't long before her boyfriend did start to get suspicious about her absences. He then came to the conclusion that she was having an affair and that the man may have been Reg. He knew that they were friends from way back, and she had even lived with Reg and Annie for a while. So he decided to follow her, and he found her with Reg at a cafe, and that confirmed to him that they were having an affair. He returned back to his flat and bundled all of her belongings into a suitcase, ready to end their relationship. But while he was doing this, he discovered her diary and looked for entries about her and Reg. But instead, he found all of the details about the drug smuggling. She had kept detailed records of the whole operation. So after finding out about the affair, he was so upset that he decided to snitch on her and the others, and he took the information to the police. And although Reg and the others didn't know it, the police started an investigation based on the information found in the diary. They went to Bombay, New Zealand, Sydney and Melbourne, checking flight details and confirming the activities of the six people as stated in the diary. And the game was up. All six were arrested and charged with importing 42 kilograms of cannabis resin worth $1.2 million. But the proceeds of their drug activity had managed to pay for bail, and they were all released pending the trial. While awaiting trial, of course, he didn't want to go to prison, and that's when he decided that he and Annie would skip bail and leave the country. The plan was to get fake passports, but with the details of real people that they knew. They needed their real identities, their full names, their dates of birth, etc. And they had to also choose people who had never previously travelled out of Australia and therefore wouldn't already have passports. They chose two people that they knew and somehow managed to extract this information from them secretly. They wanted to escape alone, not with the others, but they did tell one of the men of their plan, who ultimately decided to escape with them. The passport application required them to name a referee, so Reg thought up a plan in case the passport office checked the referees. He found a cheap office space to rent and set up three different phone lines. Each phone would be for the fake referees that they listed on their application forms. But of course, someone had to be there in case they called. So each of them had to take turns being in the office all day in case someone called, then taking on the fake identities listed as the referees. In the first few days, no one called, and they thought their elaborate scheme probably hadn't been necessary. But then Annie did receive a call when she was on her shift. She spoke to the person pretending to have known the passport applicant. They continued this routine until their passports finally arrived in the mail. So all in all, the phones had only rung once. Now with their passports, they had 10 days to disappear before their scheduled court appearance. They then booked three separate flights to Singapore and arranged a place to meet when they arrived. Everything went according to plan, and they all met up again in Singapore. After Singapore, they flew to Bombay, again on separate flights, and while in the airport, they found a copy of an Australian newspaper, but with the alarming headline, "Top Athlete Skips Bail on Drug Charges," accompanied by a photo of Reg. The three then decided they would lay low, but when their money ran low, they again got into dealing drugs. They had met an American man who worked at a boatyard, and this is where they concocted another plan to smuggle drugs. They rented a boat, and in the darkness of the night, they had a watertight container filled with 12 kilograms of hashish that they planned to secure to the underside of the boat. they would then sail with the drugs back to Australia. They got into wetsuits and drove down under the water with flashlights, looking for a spot on the hull to secure the box. They had various tools and clamps to attach it. But before they had a chance to pull it off, a motorboat with searchlights came towards them. It was the water police. Their luck had run out and they were arrested. They were taken to a detention centre which housed other foreigners who had been arrested as well. And Reg spoke with many of the other people who were detained. Some said they had been waiting for years just to have their court date. One man had been there for 8 years, still waiting for his day in court. Reg was shocked by this and hoped that this wouldn't be his fate too. After 12 months, Reg and Annie were released on bail and had to await their court appearances. But you might have already guessed it that Reg had no plan to attend court. They then got into more illegal activities to get money to escape Bombay. They got on a bus and made their escape to a place called Goa on the west coast of India, where they settled for a while, again getting into illegal activities for money. They also got new fake passports, as their other passports had been with the police in Bombay. They stayed there for 6 months until Reg saw a man reading a newspaper, which had the following headline: "Foreigners absconded to Goa." And it also had images of their passport photos. And so they grabbed their belongings and were on the run again. They boarded a plane to Kenya in Africa before heading down to Cape Town and then Sri Lanka, all the while making money from drug dealing. While in Sri Lanka, Reg concocted a scheme to travel to Amsterdam as a drug courier and then return back to Annie and then complete more trips to get more money. However, when his bags were searched, the heroin was found. And can you guess where Reg tried to conceal it? Of course, a cassette player. Well, he had succeeded before, so he decided to do the same. But this time his luck ran out. It was now December 1984. He went to prison and Annie was now left on her own, trying to evade the police herself. Reg waited 3 years until he finally got his court date in 1987. By this time, it had been 6 years since they had escaped while on bail in Australia. His court appearance went as follows. Here is part of the exchange between the judge and Reg. The judge asked Reg to state his name and then asked where he lived, to which Reg responded,
"Nowhere at the moment, because I'm touring the world. Right now I'm an unwilling guest of the Sri Lankan government in Mahara prison."
And this comment was followed with laughter from people in the courtroom.
"You are charged with contravening the Dangerous Drugs Act, in that upon, or about December 1984, you did wrongfully and unlawfully have in your possession 1.2 kilograms of diacetyl morphine, hydrochloride, commonly known as heroin, and thus did commit the crime of contravening Section 16 of the Dangerous Drugs Act of 1941. Do you understand the charge?"
"What I understand is it's a load of rubbish."
I said, "Do you understand the charge?"
"Yes."
"And how plead you? Guilty or not guilty?"
"Not guilty. Definitely not guilty, Your Honour. I deny the charge. Utter rubbish. I was going to spend a few days in Amsterdam sightseeing. A chap at the airport asked me if I could do him a favour and deliver the cassette player to his friend in Amsterdam. I had no idea it wasn't a normal cassette player. No bloody idea."
Reg had been caught because a police officer noticed that he had looked nervous in the airport, which raised his suspicion. But Reg tried to explain this by saying that he looked that way because he was nervous about flying. Reg's fingerprints had been found on the cassette player, but not on the heroin inside. So Reg defended himself by saying,
"Of course me fingerprints are on the player, because I was carrying the bloody thing."
He asserted that the heroin was planted by the officer after the player was taken from him, as his own prints were not on the heroin. But finally, after a much heated debate where Reg tried to deny the charges, the judge handed down his verdict.
The sentence of this court is that you be taken to a place of execution and there be hanged by the neck until you are dead.
But Reg kept pleading that he was innocent.
My lawyer was bloody useless, couldn't save a fish from drowning. I want an appeal.
The way Reg spoke from what you just heard is a good indication of how he conducted himself in the court. He was very sarcastic and disrespectful to the court process, using offensive language, which he was warned about many times, and he really wasn't doing himself any favours. Now, the fact that his fingerprints weren't on the heroin is interesting because obviously he had handled it, but he must have worn gloves, although this was never mentioned in his book. It was then 6 months later that he was granted an appeal, and he decided to represent himself rather than having a lawyer. He knew he was caught red-handed and didn't have much hope of escaping the conviction, but decided that he had nothing to lose. He made a request that the drugs be weighed again, and that's when a very strange thing happened. He was charged with having 1.2 kilograms, but the new weighing only showed 650 grams. Reg argued that this was not the bag that he had carried with him, and therefore that he should not be convicted. The court agreed and he was released. What a stroke of luck. Reg had only been clutching at straws when he asked for the bag to be weighed. He had no idea what had happened to the rest of the heroin, but figured the police must have stole some of it, which turned out to be a huge blessing for him. He really knew he didn't have a leg to stand on and thought his conviction and execution would be inevitable. Can you imagine how he must have felt when he left the court a free man? But that luck was about to run out. Just outside the court, he was confronted by the Australian Federal Police and subsequently arrested for skipping bail in Adelaide. Finally, his life of crime had caught up to him and he was extradited back to Australia. Annie was now on her own in Sri Lanka. In time, John received the news back in London of what had happened to Reg. He and his wife and son decided to fly to Australia and visit him in prison in Adelaide. Reg told them that he had never heard from Annie again. He ultimately spent 3 years in prison and was then released. Meanwhile, Annie got tired of being on the run and finally gave herself up in Germany and was extradited back to Australia. She received a six-month sentence before being released. And that's when the two of them were reunited, and they had spent 9 years apart. And at this point, I was thinking, Annie, don't go back to him. And it seems that she saw the light, and they decided to go their separate ways. And as for Reg's daughter, the little girl who was only a baby when he went to the UK, her life too became rather interesting. You've heard of the saying, like father, like son. Well, in Reg's case, it should be like father, like daughter. His daughter followed in her dad's footsteps and also was sent to prison for drug offences. Her home had been set up as an elaborate drug lab. She received 6 years with a three-year non-parole period, and this was back in 2011. Then it was only 8 years ago, in 2015, when a book was written about Reg's daring exploits. It was written by John's wife and son, and it's called Out of the Box by Julie and Marcus McSorley, and this is the book that I used to tell Reg's story. And here now is a final interview from Reg reflecting on his life.
Have you stayed out of crime since?
Well, I try to avoid it, yes.
Because, Reg, you'd been jailed for, drug smuggling.
Yes, I have. Because, I mean, I did athletics at a time when you never made a dollar. I just loved it. When I did retire, there was a vacuum, a huge vacuum. And I live on the edge.
I'm not a bad person. I was an athlete doing criminal things. I wasn't really a criminal, if you could understand that. I have no regrets. Why would you? You only got one shot at it. And you want to know, you want to let yourself know you're there. Yeah. So I don't regret a moment.
What an interesting interview, right? He doesn't see himself as a criminal. He used the excuse that he couldn't make money from Javelin, so why not get into drug dealing? He just laughs off everything he did. Looks like that age has not matured him one bit. And what about John? They had been good friends and still are today. But I have to question John's actions. What sort of a friend would build such a box and attempt something so risky, which could result in his friend's death? And what about his wife, Annie? Why do some women just love bad boys? We've all heard crime stories of women falling in love with men in prison, and I just don't get it. Now, I also have to question some of what Reg said in interviews, and also what was written in the book, as there are some very contradictory details. Firstly, regarding when he apparently left the pee bottle on top of the box. He told that story in his interviews, but in the book, he didn't leave it on the box. He thought he might have, but then he discovered it inside the box. So I really feel he was trying to embellish the story in order to sell the book. There are also other various details in the book which were different to his interviews. So I really cannot trust him at all. Who knows how much of the book was dramatized? So this whole story that you heard me tell, I really have no idea how much of it is actually true. And what about his last name, Spears? Is it just a coincidence that he was a javelin thrower and his name was Spears? Was this just another one of his lies? I am just so distrustful of this man. And also in the book, it spoke about the state of sports in the 1960s, that athletes had to fit their training and international competitions around their employment. Sponsorship was scant, and access to coaches depended on your wealth and where you lived. Yes, all of this was true, and it still is true today to some extent. But how many athletes resorted to criminal activities as he had done? I just thought this was a very convenient excuse. Being an Australian myself, reading his story allowed me to relate to him and his persona, which was that of a typical Aussie larrikin. So for those of you who are not Australian, the meaning of larrikin is as follows. A person who acts with apparently careless disregard for social or political conventions, a person who is unsophisticated but likable and good-hearted, a rough diamond, a joker, rowdy, mischievous and uncultivated. And this is exactly how he came across in the book and in his interviews. But in his interviews, you do get a sense of his likability. There is a charm about him. But at the end of the day, I can see through all of this. He is a criminal, and no amount of laughing it off will deny this fact, in my eyes at least. So where is Reg today? After the book was launched, he did a lot of press, but I read that after that he wanted to settle down and live quietly, so he didn't reveal his location to anyone. He is now 81 years of age. As for his daughter, just 3 years ago, at the age of 54, she was convicted of drug driving, but I haven't been able to find out anything more about Reg's wife, Annie. Now, I have one final story to tell you, which I came across while researching Reg's story, and it's very interesting. It relates to the idea of people trying to get somewhere through a very unusual method, as Reg had done. It's the story about a five-year-old girl named Charlotte May Pierstoff, but people just called her May. She lived with her family in a place called Grangeville, Idaho. May wanted to go and visit her grandmother, but she lived 75 miles away. A train ticket was too expensive for her parents to pay. It cost the equivalent of a whole day's pay. So little May was very disappointed when her parents told her that they just couldn't afford to let her go. However, That's when her father came up with a rather interesting way for May to get to her grandmother. It just so happened that May's mother had a cousin who was a railway postal carrier. Leonard Mochell rode the train carrying mail from their hometown to the town where May's grandmother lived. May's house was at the end of the railway line, and sometimes Cousin Leonard would spend the night at their house before going back on the mail train the next morning. So the next time he visited, May's mother asked him to take a parcel for her on the train. So that morning, just as he was about to leave, she went to collect the parcel and returned with little May. She was standing there wearing a warm winter coat, as it was February, and woolen stockings. She was also holding a small suitcase, and Leonard was confused, expecting to see a parcel of some type. And that's when May's mother explained the whole situation. So the year was 1914, and the United States Postal Service had introduced a new mail service just the year before in 1913, which allowed parcels up to 50 pounds to be mailed. Before that, only letters and small packages up to 4 pounds could be sent. So this had given May's mother an idea. She had gone to the post office and checked all the regulations about the new parcel post system. Parcels could not exceed 50 pounds. May weighed only 47 pounds, and there was nothing that said that you could not send a child through the mail. So that's what she decided to do, to send May with Leonard on the train. Of course, he was rather shocked and afraid that he may lose his job, but she eventually convinced him and off they went. Just like other mail, May had 53 cents worth of stamps placed on her coat. So they rode the train together and arrived in the town of Lewiston, where Leonard delivered little May to her grandmother, who had no idea she was coming, and one can only imagine her reaction upon hearing the story of how May had made it there. Of course, the other passengers on the train must have been most surprised at what they had witnessed, none more so than the conductor. He thought the story was newsworthy and contacted the media. The story of a little girl being posted through the postal service appeared in newspapers all across America. After May's story came to light, two things happened as a result. Firstly, more people began sending small children and babies through the mail. Postal workers started posing for photos with the children they were carrying, and you can find many of these photos online. They're very interesting to look at. They're standing there with their big postal bags with little children or babies inside them. Secondly, the Postal Service eventually saw the need for a change in the regulations. They conceded that there were indeed loopholes. As well as children, animals were also sent via post. But it wasn't until 60 years later that the regulations were finally changed, prohibiting children and animals from being shipped by mail. So, as you saw, Reg's story didn't relate to schools, but there were certainly crimes involved, and I just thought it was a really interesting story to tell. And you would have noticed that I used various voices in the episode. Some were computer generated, but one voice was that of a real person who follows my podcast. His voice was that of the main character, Reg. I approached him to be involved because he is actually Australian. So who better to use for an authentic Aussie accent than an authentic Aussie himself? So thank you very much to David Power, who has also lent his voices on other episodes, including episode 200, where he did a very convincing Texan accent. So thank you very much, David. So to end this episode, who better to provide the final quote than Reg himself? I've seen so much and lived it all. I wanted to bite the earth and taste it. It is both bitter and sweet. And if I had my time to live over again, I wouldn't change a damn thing. Bye for now, and remember to be a good apple.
Oh, babe, come fly with me. Let's fly, let's fly. Pack a small bag.